Tonight on Arena, The Beast, Sting and Bonus Track are the movies up for review, and a new production of Elizabeth Cootey's Quiver play, The Sugar Wife at the Abbey. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us live on the live stream, rte.ie/arena. And if you're listening to that opening menu and wondering, what's a quaver play? It's nothing. It's a Quaker play that I'll be talking about a little bit later in the programme. However, we start this evening with film reviews. Love Across Time, Love Across the Classroom, and Scary Looking Spiders. No love at all there. Bonus Track is a sweet rom-com slash coming-of-age story about an awkward teen called George who loves music and avoids coming to terms with his burgeoning sexuality. It stars Jack Davenport and newcomer Joe Anders, with Challengers star Josh O'Connor in a small role, though he did come up with the story along with co-writer Mike Gilbert. Arachnophobes beware, in Sting, an increasingly large and hungry alien spider takes over an unassuming home. Damon Lumby and Dave Hanratty have been to the cinema for us. They're with me in studio this evening. But we're going to start with Bertrand Bonello's latest film, The Beast, vast, unsettling drama of the future and the past, starring Léa Seydoux and chief protagonist Gabrielle, and 1917's George MacKay, or MacKay, is he, as Louis. It follows a doomed romance between Gabrielle and Louis across three different time frames: Paris in 1910, just prior to the Great Flood, Los Angeles in and around 2014, and then in 2024, when the majority of the Paris workforce has been replaced by artificial intelligence. The film is loosely inspired by Henry James' 1903 story, The Beast in the Jungle, about a man paralysed by his neurotic conviction that something awful is about to happen to him. The Beast invisibly crouched in the jungle of the future. The three different time narratives, or time frames, or narrative frames here, first of all, Dave, maybe just expand a little bit on what we get. Does it run in chronological order? Does it go straight from one to the other to the next?
It does, but you also go back on occasion. So this is it's quite sprawling. It's very ambitious. The movie is about 2.5 hours long. And, you know, if ever you needed to kind of pay attention and not look away from the screen, because you may find yourself in a wildly different setting altogether. Effectively, Léa Seydoux and George MacKay play these, I guess, different versions of the same character to an extent, and so you have those actors across the entire thing. There are two leads, and you know they take up the vast majority of what goes on here. Léa Seydoux is carrying this film on her shoulders with a hell of a performance. But yeah, you get like period France, and you get like kind of 10 years ago Los Angeles, and then you get 2044, where AI has done what we all hope it won't do and render us completely useless. And so you have this kind of plot where Léa Seydoux's Gabrielle in the future is effectively trying to kind of rid herself of her emotions by engaging in an experiment that will see her traverse her past lives.
So you kind of, the idea, I think, Dee, is you purify your DNA. Isn't that the idea? By going back through your past lives and getting rid of the, whatever, the flotsam and jetsam that has happened to you in the past. They don't, in the AI does not want people to be emotional. No emotions, irrationality only, please.
Yeah, and it's a strange one because we kind of see that theme kind of emerge again and again in the movie. Like, for example, in the 1910 period, the character of Gabrielle, she designs dolls, and she talks about how the design of their faces kind of mimics hers, and then she kind of poses, which is basically this like slightly pouty face, and you know how she kind of has like this round kind of natural cheeks as it is. So I suppose seeing that kind of, you know, very like stoic, neutral doll face, that kind of, you know, mirrors back that whole theme about, you know, how emotions and deep feeling are meant to be hidden in polite society. And then when we go into the 2014 era, she's kind of a wannabe actress. So again, you have that whole idea of like, you know, masking emotions and stuff like that. So thematically, it's kind of an interesting movie. But I would say that if you're here for kind of, you know, entertainment, it maybe doesn't always kind of deliver on that. But I did find it absolutely fascinating that they were able to kind of merge these very different genres, which is kind of period melodrama and, you know, sci-fi epic, because you don't see that in a lot of movies, do you?
Yeah, I mean, it is. They are three very different time frames. And I think there was a taste factor involved in get on with it, basically being one of your desires because of that period setting, Dave, am I right?
Yeah, I wasn't mad about the period setting. It's not that I have any problem with films set in that time period or anything, but I just thought it was a bit kind of draggy. And I did wonder, I was like, okay, when am I going to connect with this? You know, I'm admiring it for sure. You know, it feels very austere, but will it actually grab me? Because from a plot perspective point of view, it's unconventional. Yeah. But then you do move into 2014 Los Angeles and the characters are now different, played by the same actors. And I thought it gave George MacKay in particular a lot more kind of free rein to establish himself. He's playing a much different character. He plays this kind of gentlemanly figure in the 1910, and then in 2014 he plays what, you know, we've come to refer to as incels, like a character who believes that he deserves women but can't get with one.
An involuntary celibate, yeah.
Yeah, and it's very much riffing on a real life killer, and to the point that his actions, like kind of live blogging himself, and even the words he are saying are taken directly from that real life person, which is quite unsettling. And I will say George MacKay does an incredible job of being unsettling. Lea Seydoux, by contrast, plays this kind of wannabe model actress, and she's house-sitting in this gorgeous home in the Hollywood Hills. And at that point, you know, that's when I kind of tuned in, which I think does say more about me than about somebody else, because I do think that someone who loved, say, Portrait of a Lady on Fire or Dangerous Liaisons may well be drawn more to the other time period. So I did appreciate that there actually was a different thing for the synapses in your brain to kind of connect to, depending on your level of preference.
And I guess, too, I think in terms of the production design, the way the different periods are demarcated, you were quite fond of that, Dee.
Yeah, I thought it was absolutely incredible. And I was impressed particularly by that kind of futuristic backdrop of 2044. You know, one of the kind of you know, visuals that comes to mind is she's immersed in this kind of black liquid and this needle is kind of coming towards her face quite ominously. And I think that the film does a really good job at, you know, kind of building up that sense of dread. The 2014 setting as well, as you see it kind of, you know, obviously there's a big jump from 2010 to 2014, but you're kind of trying to add up in your head, how did we go from
2010 to 2044?
Exactly.
It?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. In that 30-year epoch. So, yeah, I was really quite impressed by the production design of it, but less so by other things. For example, in the dialogue, there were kind of all these weird pointed silences and dramatic beats, which I was trying to figure out if they were trying to build up some kind of chemistry between our two leads in MacKay and Seydoux. But for me, it almost came across as a bit silly and mawkish. So it didn't always work for me, but I could appreciate, you know, its world building at the same time. The future, for example, really drew to mind David Cronenberg's recent Crimes of the Future remake, and I'm sure other kind of sci-fi epics will come.
Stars from UD.
It wasn't really for me, if I'm honest. I did think there was enough intrigue in it, but I found that I was kind of getting overly detached to it. I wasn't finding myself very moved by it. I was kind of half wondering, is this almost the point of the movie, you know, to get rid of emotions or something like that? But it wasn't particularly entertaining. Two and a half for me.
And I suppose there are potentially big themes in here. Are they aired and given chance to breathe enough for you as you give us your stars, Dave?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, like I said, this film is very patient. Dee is correct that there are a lot of pointed silences. It is 2.5 hours long. I quite like the scope of it, actually. I was never bored, apart from maybe in that opening stretch where I was kind of like, I need this to connect right now. I didn't connect with it on an emotional level, which I wish I did. I like this film quite a great deal. I wish I loved it. And I do actually want to see it a second time. Lea Seydoux's performance is absolutely mesmerizing. She's one of the great actors, and it's time to start putting her in that conversation, I think. And the work that she does here, even with just her facial and body language, is out of this world. I was less convinced by George MacKay. It's a good performance, but I didn't buy the romance between the two of them. But I do think, unfortunately, it is quite derivative. I found myself thinking of so many other films during this, which isn't a knock on it necessarily, but I kind of wish it was a true original. I do want to see it again. It's 4 stars from me.
4 from you, and it's a mixture of French and English, we should say that as well. Let us move on to Sting, an unapologetic horror and thriller with a sci-fi twist. Centres on Charlotte, a rebellious 12-year-old girl who finds a tiny spider in her apartment building. She keeps it in a jar. Guess what? It starts to grow. Tears going across the studio. And when it grows, it gets very hungry. Big fan of spiders, Dave.
I can't stand them. Yes, I am. I'll say it out loud for everyone to hear. I am an arachnophobe, and I was dreading going to see this film for this wonderful job that I get to do. However, what you just did there with the noise that you made with your hand, I found more unsettling than what unfolds.
The film.
Yeah, truly. And there's a big reason for that, and the reason comes down to how they present this. So, you know, like, practical effects are so important. If something is, you suspend your disbelief when you watch any film, especially a horror film. And look, I don't want to get too precious about critiquing a giant spider movie, but the giant spider has to have weight and presence and substance, and it's got to make me sit there and be wanting to bolt out of the cinema. However, I thought it was, you know, perfectly fine. It gave me no trouble. I just wish money was spent on constructing a physical thing that could freak me out.
Dee, were you frightened?
I wasn't, but that's why I enjoyed it. As I mentioned before on the show, I'm not a particularly big fan of horror movies, but I do like when there's something a bit going on in the movie as opposed to, you know, just jump scare after jump scare. And I think that Sting is kind of interesting in how it kind of establishes this family drama around the character of Charlotte. You know, she has this baby brother. She's living with her mum and her stepdad as well. And there's kind of tensions in that relationship between her and her stepdad, who's kind of really trying to fill in the shoes of, you know, that fatherly role. And I thought it was interesting as well that he's kind of the second lead character. He is a repairman and he also works at, you know, writing these comic books with Charlotte's mother. He's constantly brought in to kind of do all of these fixer-upper jobs around the dilapidated apartment block. So he's kind of being pulled between one way and the next. He's coming under increasing pressure. And I thought it was quite interesting seeing that storyline because I thought the tension building in that storyline was kind of working in parallel to the kind of, you know, straight up horror elements of the movie. So I thought that gave it a bit of something more. And, you know, you have a couple of, you know, very strong performances in there. I thought the young actress who played Charlotte, Ayla Brown, was really good. And as well, I could appreciate, you know, the comedy in it. There's a character in this who's played by Jermaine Fowler. He's this like bug exterminator who's like running around trying to catch this guy.
Let's listen to him, actually, which it is kind of, even for arachnophobes, I think there potentially is a little bit of a laugh in here, if you don't get too freaked out by it. Jermaine Fowler, as Dee said, playing Frank the Exterminator, and he's come to investigate a mysterious noise in Helga's apartment. Helga is played by Noni Hazelhurst.
You called about the noises in your walls, right?
Oh, no, 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 not me.
You sure about that?
There's a noise.
Yeah. It's noise, all right.
There was someone back there?
There is noise.
That's a lot of noisier spider than my little boy running across the desk with my fingers. Did you not get any jump scares here? You were saying that my fingers frightened you more, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, I kept waiting for it, but it was just like, you can time these jump scares, you know, you can set your watch by them. And another problem with this as well is that, like, it's too dark, like, quite literally. You can't see what's going on. And that's, look, that's smoke and mirrors. That's to mask a budget. Yeah. You got characters kind of getting dragged off screen. There is a good action climax here. It does kind of get a bit gnarly at times. And there was a couple of demises for people that I kind of was like raising my eyebrows at, being like, did that person really deserve to go out that way? That's a bit much. And that's not bad in your average horror movie. You know, there is good schlock here. There are some funny characters. It's not a failure by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, I also don't need a kitchen sink family drama in my giant spider movie. Like, I'm going for one or the other. Yeah, look, if I'm going for the giant spider, I'm going for the giant spider. Don't give me, like, you know, a squabbling family. Yeah. The setting is good too as well, I will say. The dilapidated apartment, that's a good use of a small budget. You know, you're kind of confining it to rooms, you're populating them with that, you give a good layout. It's kind of a bit like Aliens at times. It's a 2 out of 5 for me.
Yeah, and did you like that family drama aspect of it? I think you did, Dee.
I did, and I kind of, you know, I even enjoyed like the kind of silly horror aspects of it. I think that, in fairness, it does make very good use of frightening practical effects. There are a couple of creatures who live around the apartment, kind of pets, who live in the apartment, who come to quite sad, you know, ends. You know, yeah, people might be a bit upset about that, but I thought that it was, you know, quite well won. It's not one for arachnophobes. I did have in my notes, probably not one for hardcore horror fans, but then again, I'm not a hardcore horror fan, so I found it to be a bit of fun. So 3 stars for me.
3 stars, and if you're an arachnophobe or a hardcore horror, don't go. Seems to be the advice from Dee. Finally then, bonus track. This is a gentle coming-of-age story. A music-obsessed teen called George finds a kindred spirit and maybe love in Max, the charismatic new boy in his school. Is it kind of a fairly straightforward high school type of movie or music school type of movie then, Diet? It has that feel off it from that description.
If you've watched the Netflix series Heartbreaker, this movie reminded me a lot about that. But then I didn't exactly, you know, not mind that, because I find Heartbreaker to be quite charming, and I found, you know, this movie to be that as well. I did think that the music aspect of it, so one aspect of the movie is that George, you know, he is struggling in school. He really wants to prove his worth at the upcoming talent show. So he kind of befriends this new boy, Max, who is the son of a famous music duo, and they kind of are working on this act together. So that's one aspect of the story that I'm not sure is fully kind of developed as to what George's musical talent actually is. He seems to like kind of be working on the backdrop, on like a backtrack to certain like music songs he's working on, but then all of a sudden he can write music. So I didn't fully understand that. But then the other part of the movie is that there's kind of this romance developing between George and Max. And I thought that that aspect of the movie was what I was personally more drawn to. And I could really see like an authentic, slow build up between these two characters. And it was really quite lovely to watch.
All right. Well, you're going to get a bit of both, I think, here. It's clear that George, played by Joe Anders, does need to be in a music school from this clip. He needs to do a lot of work on his music, actually. Or maybe he's just nervous. And he's showcasing his keyboard prowess in large inverted commas to Samuel Small's Max.
Sorry, that's not usually how I play it. That was horrible. I'm sorry, I didn't eat breakfast this morning because I kept hitting snooze on my alarm, so I'm feeling a little bit shaky. But I can imagine that, but like twice, maybe even three times better. I'll just play it again.
I like it.
It's good. But not good enough, so.
I mean, I won't lie, you are a bit rough around the edges.
So rough.
You know, it's its own thing.
Oh, right.
It's unique. Yeah, and all the best things are, so.
That's Samuel Small as Max and Joe Anders as George in that scene from Bonus Track. Listening to that, you get a sense, he's kind of nervous around him as much as anything else. So they're getting that kind of emotional and sexual tension that exists between the two quite well on the basis of that clip. Does that hold throughout the movie, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, like there's chemistry between the two actors, I guess. But everything here kind of feels very, very wish fulfillment-y. I mean, like Josh O'Connor, who came up with the story for this, he's really having a moment, obviously, with Challengers and La Chimera in recent weeks. But this film could be called First Draft. I mean, and I did think it is quite sweet, but there's just kind of a lot of archetypes at play here. It's a good thing, I think, even in 2024, when we should be well past this, but it is a good thing that they're presenting a queer romance without judgment, you know. But everything comes a bit too easy to everybody. You can telegraph every scene before it happens. There's a talent show in the third act. Gosh, I wonder if they'll play together, all that kind of stuff. I'm really not giving you spoilers here, guys, if you've seen the movie before. But it's just charming enough. And I was impressed by the young actors. I mean, it's a very well-worn tale, you know. Awkward, shy kid. In comes the cool guy. They make friends, but there's a bit more to it. I mean, you probably wouldn't have got this film 20 years ago because it would be seen. Like, the fact that it's unremarkable is good because, you know, the message is strong. And I think it will hit well with a young audience, even like budding musicians. There is some very good music in this as well. I mean, any film that has Men's Needs by The Cribs in there as a needle drop, I mean, automatically, you know, come on. I'm giving you a decent enough review.
Yeah, so the music that we just heard is not a signifier of the general quality.
It rather brought me back to my own days as a struggling drummer. I never became a great one, but I became an okay one. And and that's okay, guys.
Yeah, I was wondering, was he actually on the drums that he was there rather than the keyboards? Because the drums seemed to be having the problems. Dee, did it charm you as you give me your stars?
Yes, I'm going to give this 3 stars. I thought that it did capture the awkwardness of being a teen quite well. I think there's a nice message for young people that if you're lost as to what to do with your life and career, everything is going to be okay. It's an obvious choice for one for teens to watch with their parents, but I think audiences outside that range will be pleasantly surprised too. But it is fairly conventional and predictable at the same time, but aren't so many movies these days.
Yeah. It's an easy watch. I mean, like,
it's a rom-com.
Yeah, it's pleasant. I mean, it doesn't need to be anything more than it is. So you can't really go after it too hard for not having a more developed third act or something.
Did I get stars from you?
It'll be 3 stars from me.
3.
And it is charming.
3.
Ah, so good, solid 3. Charming seems to be the agreed opinion then on Bonus Track. And the other two films that Dee Mullumby and Dave Hanratty were speaking about this evening, Sting, and before that, what is it called?
I can't think of it.
The Beast is the name of the film we were talking about before that. Sugar is a touchy subject in The Sugar Wife, Elizabeth Cootey's 2005 play about to open at the Abbey Theatre. Set in 1850s Dublin, Hannah and Samuel Tewkley are a Quaker couple with a thriving tea and sugar business. We first meet Hannah, however, in the Coombe, where she's visiting the sick. She is a woman of strong moral conscience who invites Sarah Worth, a former slave and now an anti-slavery campaigner, and her friend Alfred Darby to stay for 10 weeks while Sarah is on a lecture tour around Europe and now in Dublin. Director Annabel Cumann is with me here in studio, and Elizabeth Cootey, writer, is on the line. Liz, and I suppose it is a very touchy subject, sugar, here, because it becomes the whole idea of capitalism and how you make your money becomes an issue early on. But the Dublin we meet, the Dublin of 1850, what interested you in that period, that mid-19th century period, and specifically the Quaker community in Dublin in that period?
Hi. I've kind of always liked history, and I was looking for an idea for a play, because I've been commissioned to write a play by Rough Magic. And I just thought, I didn't think this story had been told. It seemed like a story that hadn't been seen, you know, in Irish theatre before. And I just thought, there's something about the Quakers. I think I was probably in Bewley's, you know, looking at the sign that they used to have saying Bewley's established 1840. And I was just kind of thinking around, you know, the tea and coffee and sugar and how involved the Quakers were in campaigning against slavery. And a lot of that was about being anti-sugar, because that was a major crop that was being produced. And yet at the same time, all of the wealth of the Bewley's cafes, were kind of very much involved with sugar, because tea and coffee and chocolate, they all really kind of drove the consumption of sugar. And it is a touchy subject. It's kind of just, you know, it's sort of interesting. There was a really interesting book called Sweetness and Power, which was about how sugar, you kind of changed the world, really. And obviously it's addictive. The whole of Europe got addicted to sugar. And then they wanted more and more, cheaper and cheaper, and more exploitative ways of getting more and more sugar. And at the same time, you know, the Quakers are really interesting, to me, really interesting community. Very socially conscious, very wanting to make a better world, and yet still quite mixed up in all of this complicated trade.
At one point in your own life, had you, maybe too strong to say that you were involved in the Quaker movement, but you certainly, you attended some Quaker I don't know whether you should call them ceremonies or services. I don't know what the correct word is.
Meetings.
That's, of course, a Quaker meeting. That's why it's called a meeting house. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. No, I did for quite a few years when I was a teenager. My mother started, you know, took me along when I was a child, and then I continued to go because I kind of really liked the ethos. The Society of Friends is their sort of official name, and they were, you know, the group that I was kind of, a regular member of. I think it was also connected with the campaign for nuclear disarmament at the time. You know, which I felt very strongly about as a teenager in the 1980s. I mean, I still do, but, you know, so it was kind of, it was sort of politically was quite close to my feelings. And also I just really liked the way that it just created this space of quietness and people being able to speak their mind, you know.
And there is a wonderful aspect in that respect, Annabel, in the nature of the Quaker community in this play and in that period. There is a type of austerity, isn't quite the right word, but very firm moral compass, which they absolutely, the characters of Hannah and Samuel in particular, who are the husband and wife, this very strong moral compass that guides them. But within all of that, in inverted commas, austerity, is this wonderfully gentle, supporting mood to the Dublin of the time, just post-famine, certainly at this point in time, and with some really serious social difficulties, which are, I suppose, presented in many ways by the character of Martha Ryan in the play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose the word is plainness.
Yeah.
So, and it's really interesting because like they talk about the elders in the play and the elders' rules and advices. And talking with Liz, she was saying there's kind of nothing necessarily written down about what are the, there's no kind of rules or specific creed to the church itself.
Kind of discussed at these meetings, I guess, in some ways, isn't it?
My understanding is that it's kind of finding it from within, what is a truth. Finding a sense of God from within, and kind of working out what your calling is and trying to live by that, and to pare back all things that are kind of seen as frivolous. I was quite interested actually in when I was starting to research for the play, just even in the Quakers' relationship going, you know, to theatre and how theatre was seen as something kind of moving away from one's true self and extravagance. And so in terms of what the production is looking at is kind of interested in looking at almost that kind of forum style theatre where a meeting can almost become a platform to discuss ethical ideas. But as the play moves on and they get caught more in their desires and wants and needs, that actually it can become more theatrical in some
Absolutely.
Way.
And I suppose there is marriage, there's money and there is morality. We've spoken a little bit about both of those aspects, but I think I said somewhere along the way, and I think it's possibly in the publicity material, money, marriage and morality are the three M's that are in there. The marriage is interesting here between Hannah and Samuel. There's maybe respect is the best word. There's certainly respect between the two of them. We begin to question the nature of the love between the two of them, but things are thrown totally awry with the arrival of a couple of, not strangers, but of a couple of new individuals into the Tuchley family, Liz.
Yeah, that's right. So Hannah and Samuel are the Quaker couple, and they're married, but they're childless. And so that's a bit of a problem in kind of bubbling along for them, because they, particularly Samuel, really, really wants children. And that's kind of not happening. And it's been not happening for, you know, quite a long time. So there's sort of all these tensions that are going on in their marriage that in some ways they're not exactly brilliantly suited to each other. You know, Samuel's much more practical and, you know, quite a talented kind of business guy. And Hannah is much more, I guess, maybe more sort of cerebral and much more sort of anxious. But also what's going on, I think, is that Samuel's much more able to express himself and have kind of agency because he's a man. And Hannah is much more constrained in what she can do. So there's this kind of sense of her kind of straining at the leash and kind of looking for freedom in different ways. And then that's really brought into relief when Sarah Worth and Alfred arrive, and they're obviously talking about freedom in a whole different context.
Alfred is an ex-Quaker. He and his family were very involved in business, but he doesn't like the sort of business side of the matter. At least that's what he's presenting to us, that he has questions around that. But the Sarah Worth character is phenomenally interesting here, because we're talking about Hannah, the Quaker woman, her involvement in the anti-slavery movement. Sarah Worth, this character that you have, we all know that Frederick Douglass, the great anti-slavery campaigner, came to Ireland at a certain point around this period. Sarah Worth is on a European tour. She is a former slave. That character, is it based? It has a feeling of some kind of reality behind it.
Yeah, there was a woman lecturer from America, a black woman called Sarah Parker Remond, who came to Dublin and who was a very active anti-abolitionist campaigner, speaker, lecturer. And she toured the whole of Europe, and she was very active in the American anti-slavery movement. So I came across the fact that she had given lectures in Dublin, and I just thought, oh, that's, you know, really fascinating. And then she went back to America, and she actually became a physician. She trained to become a doctor. So she was like a, you know, a really important and interesting figure. So I called my character Sarah after her. But the original Sarah Parker Remond was not enslaved. She was born as a free woman, but she was just very, very actively involved in the campaign. So there is sort of, it's all possible. Like, yes, it's a fictionalized version of stuff that is, you know, not outside the bounds.
Yeah, you're looking
reality.
For plausibility. And Alfred, the man who's played by Chris Whalley in this, I'll go through some of the other cast members shortly as well. But Alfred Darby, the ex-Quaker played by Chris Whalley, basically, he bought her freedom. And that brings in an interesting aspect to, you know, the idea of the woman being bought. You know, in this case, her freedom is bought for her. That gives a very an interesting dynamic to the relationship between the Chris Whalley character of Alfred and Sarah, the abolitionist, Annabelle.
Mm. Yeah, like, I think central to the relationships is a notion of trade. So you talked about the relationship.
The marriage has a trade aspect,
and there's a kind of a promise and a trade of what, why we are both in a marriage. And then similarly with Alfred and Sarah. So I suppose there's a complex relationship to money and what money can both positively and negatively do, and what drives people to want money and how they use it as well. So, yeah, so there's a complex relationship, which I won't give away at the moment, but between Alfred and Sarah. But I do think the stories speak to each other. So you have the story of Sarah, who was formerly enslaved, and her experience. And she tells the story of her great-grandmother and how it, through her lectures, and then how that speaks to, I suppose, the world of the relationships in Dublin. Yeah. And in a way, the ones in Dublin, if you look at their behaviours, they're like the tip of the iceberg. But if you accentuate and exaggerate those behaviours, you look at the macro exploitation of millions of people through enslavement and killings as well. And you see kind of what looks like happening on a domestic level and the narratives that people can kind of tell themselves and excuse themselves of.
Yeah,
and
you
suddenly go, if you actually expand that out, you're dealing with huge consequences.
Yeah, because we are looking at the transactionary nature of marriage here as well.
Exactly.
In that Samuel, played by Peter Gaynor, is quite a businessman. And Hannah Tuchley, played by Siobhan Cullen, there's an aspect to which she needs support at a certain point in her life. And he needs a wife. And that's a reasonable transaction for the two of them. But we have, as we said, Chris Whalley as Alfred Darby and Siobhan Cullen as Hannah Tuchley. I mean, phenomenal casting to get, given that they're on the telly at the moment in Bodkin together. It's a very different type of dynamic between them in this play.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I hadn't realised they were doing that. So I haven't yet seen it. I kind of thought I'll keep my focus on the play.
Yeah.
So I'll probably indulge in watching that afterwards.
When the play's up and running.
When the play's up and running. But no, I was delighted. But they've got a fantastic cast of five actors. So, yeah.
And Tara Parker. Is it Tara Parker?
Tara Porter
as Sarah Worth.
Yeah.
And then Peter Gaynor as the husband, and Shifrinie Eilish as Martha Ryan,
right,
who's the Dublin character.
Yeah, well, she's actually not Dublin in our version. So she's Southwest. She's from the Southwest.
All right, but it works equally well. It's a young Irish woman is what we need there.
Yeah, I guess because I was doing so much research on it and seeing that, you know, the migration of people, obviously, from the country in the mid-1840s was huge. And much of the poverty of people on the street were from migration into the city because of the famine. It was really interesting just to actually learn about Dublin through those years of the famine, because so often you don't learn about what's happening in Dublin.
Yeah.
So there's a great book by UCD Press that just came out, and I started to read that and just kind of learn about that period as it put, you know, within the city, and how did the city, you know, respond to it. And we get that from the Quakers as well.
And the play was first produced, as you said, Liz, by Rough Magic back in 2005. Have you revisited the script in any way, or did the presence of this new cast make you rethink any of the aspects of the play?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, every new production is a whole new thing, you know. We have revisited it. And obviously it's quite some time since it first went on in 2005. I mean, it's been produced in America It was translated into German and Georgian, I believe. And so it's had a few outings in sort of different forms. I don't want to give too much away, but certainly certain aspects have been highlighted more and others have been pulled back a little. We'll see how it
how it plays out. I won't go into the detail of it, but technology and the technology in and around photography plays a very important part in this, and it brings up another set of interesting transactional processes in the play, but I don't want to give too much away in that respect. You might tell me what kind of Abbey stage we'll be looking at. This is a play, in some ways a small story, but with very big themes, Annabelle. Mm. What will we be looking at on the stage? What will we see? How real a Dublin is it? How abstract a Dublin is it?
Yeah, I guess it's more pairing back. So quite a plain set, to use the Quaker word. I'm using the meeting house as a basic form, and also the idea of forum theatre, where ideas, so the meeting house can become a place to work through ethical questions, which are the scenes, because the play is framed by the 20th of March, and then you go back. So in a way, we're not necessarily looking at naturalistic setup of going from one room to the other, but looking at how they create scenes to work through ideas. Well, and questions.
Certainly is an interesting one. The script, I must say, I enjoyed enormously reading it over the past couple of days. Elizabeth Cootey, writer, and Annabelle Cumman, director, thank you both for being with us this evening. And The Sugar Wife previews at the Abbey Theatre from the 13th of June. It opens then on the 18th and it runs through until July 20th. Further details on abbeytheatre.ie. Now, coming into the summer, Arena will be going on the road. We have two trips to Galway planned. One, our annual trip to the Galway International Arts Festival, which opens on July the 15th. And the week before that, we'll also be in Galway for the annual Film Fla. The Fla opens with Kneecap and their film, which wowed audiences at the Sundance Film Festival. On the last Sunday of the Film Fla, July the 14th, I will be doing a public interview with the great Brian Cox, classically trained Shakespearean actor. He has starred as the patriarch of the Logan family in Succession, of course, which won him a Golden Globe Award, starred in numerous movies in the Bourne franchise, Manhunter, Churchill and Nuremberg. We will be talking to him on Sunday, July the 14th, in front of a live audience at the Galmont Hotel in Galway. That's at 3 p.m. Full information on that on the Filmfla website, galwayfilmfla.com. And we're hearing that the public interview is already sold out, but don't despair. We will be broadcasting that interview with Brian Cox the following Wednesday, July the 17th. Brian Cox recorded a reading of a poem by the late poet and teacher Rifat Al-Arir. Rifat taught literature and creative writing at the Islamic University of Gaza. He was killed along with his sister, brother and four of his nephews on December the 7th, 2023, during an Israeli airstrike. This is the voice of Brian Cox.
If I Must Die by Rifat Al-Arir, November the 1st, 2023. If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings. Make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, sees the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment, an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale.
The words of Rifat Al-Arir, read there by Brian Cox, and the poem, If I Must Die. Carlo dance artist Roisin Whelan creates highly physical and technical demanding dance works with strong narratives that are accessible to all, regardless of age, gender, socioeconomic background. I'm going to rename her now. Roisin has worked with Matthew Bourne and choreographed for Netflix series to boot. As part of the upcoming Carlo Arts Festival, she presents Eivor, meaning reflections, reflecting on celebratory moments experienced over many lifetimes, from ceilidhs to dance halls and plays to partying, in a dynamic suite of dance performances in the grounds of Carlow College. She also presents The Galaxy of Occupations, a performance that reaches for the stars. Delighted to be joined this evening by Roisin Whelan. It's one of the things, Roisin, that strikes me. You in the publicity material for this set of dances in Carlow, the emphasis is on that narrative structure, particularly in contemporary dance. I suppose the story can often get lost. Did you want to bring that aspect into contemporary dance movement? Was that important for you?
Yeah, definitely. I was really fortunate, as you said, to work with Matthew Bourne early on in my career, and he makes really narrative work. And I really saw how audiences managed to connect to dance so much better, in my opinion, when it was narrative and almost more theatrical in a way, if that makes sense, in terms of how traditional theatre might be. So I was really keen to bring that into my own style of work and to still push the dance aspect, but to make sure that people understood what was happening.
Yeah, so that you're telling a story. And Matthew Bourne, for those who are saying, oh, I know him, but how do I know him? Well, you know him from The Black Swan Lake, and of course, which is the big scene towards the end of Billy Elliot, even if you haven't seen the actual Matthew Bourne production itself. But that narrative, you worked with Matthew Bourne on a production of Romeo and Juliet, I think. Was it, Roisin?
Yeah, it was my very first job out of university. So I was really fortunate to get such an amazing job straight away. So I worked with him I was one of the female characters in Romeo and Juliet. And we made the show from scratch, all the dancers and him together. So also that was an amazing experience to get to create something on a massive scale, like 25 dancers with a live orchestra every night. And he had set it in kind of like an institution. And that was a bit more vague, whether that was a prison or a mental institution or a hospital or a different place. So he was also like flipping the narrative that we know on its head, kind of a thing as well. So I think that was great to be in a creative process that was so specific about taking a story that everyone knows and trying to make it a little bit different but still relatable and understandable.
Which is exactly what he did with the all-male Swan Lake. He kind of turned the story on its head in a similar type of way, didn't he? Let's talk a little bit about the shows then that you're involved in. The Galaxy of Occupations. This is, I think, for a younger audience, aimed at a younger audience, Roisin?
Yeah, so that's for 6 to 10-year-olds. And it's a show that we actually got commissions to make for Tipperary Dance Festival and by Dublin City Council. So we've performed it now. We actually performed it twice today in Newbridge in a school there. So we've performed it for over 2,500 children 30 times already. So it's really wonderful. We've never performed it in Carlow. So it's going to be really fabulous to go and do it on home turf. And it basically just looks at all the amazing things that kids can be that maybe they don't see, you know. So, you know, they might see that their parents are a teacher or an aunt is a farmer or something like that. But what if they were an astronaut or a scientist or a games designer, you know, things that might be a bit more kind of might seem a bit further away or out of their reach, and actually showing that they can be anything.
Obviously, one of the things, well, I'm judging by the name of this piece of music that I want to play, Chef Goo. I'm presuming that one of the things you said, you know, you can be a chef as well as everything else if you want to be.
Exactly. We worked with an amazing composer. Her name is Aoife Kavanagh, and she's also from Carlow. And the costume designer, Claire Smith, is also from Carlow. So it's very Carlow-based production, but we worked with her on creating like loads of sound bites of different places and different jobs that were really relatable for the kids. So for the chef, we obviously looked a lot at like Ratatouille and this idea of, you know, like the underscore of what might be in a kitchen and how that busyness comes into the music. So that was really kind of a big collaboration with her on how we bring the jobs to life through sound.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to how Aoife Kavanagh imagines then what a chef or a kitchen might sound like in Carlow. This sounds like a great kitchen to be in, I have to say. Chef Goo, the music there of Aoife Kavanagh, in that part of The Galaxy of Occupations, one of the pieces that Roisin Whelan of Roisin Whelan Dance will be performing or involved in performing at the upcoming Carlo Arts Festival. You've worked with Aoife quite a bit, and I can see why and I can hear why within that.
Yeah.
I mean, that really does create, it does create a kind of a Ratatouille-style kitchen. And is, have you a little tango going on in there?
Yeah, there's a little bit of a tango at the end with the aprons and the dancers, you know, so to create that image as well. Yeah, we have a really wonderful relationship. Aoife also has created the music for basically most of the shows that I've made. I made a show for Ballet Ireland that they commissioned me to make, and she also did the music for that.
The other side of it is the other show that is called Aoife or Reflections. This is, it sounds like it maybe aimed at an older audience, but it is about remembering occasions, happy and sad, or mostly happy, Roisin?
It's a bit of a mixed bag. So we had a really big conversation about, obviously, this idea of images. And, you know, when you think back on memory, you remember them differently. Or every time you re-remember this image or this time, you're like, oh, who was there? And you might lose a bit of it and put something else in. So within the memories, there's some of these really joyful moments. And then there's these slight kind of fractures that you're like, oh, something has gone missing, or something is a bit awry, and then you come back into the memory again. So we've kind of tried to bring the audience on a really nice journey there with, as you said, kind of these like party moments, and then we see a really small argument that descends kind of into chaos, and we actually use a bit of the bolero music for that.
We've all been at those family occasions where some things go slightly awry.
They're the common ones, though.
And within the performance of Aoife as well, you're involving the Irish Sign Language interpreter, Shelley Gibson. What is Shelley's role within this, and why was that important to you, Aoife? Roisin.
So Shelley actually signs for the children's show because we have some text in that show. But for Aoife, we don't have any text, so there's no signing in the second show. But yeah, her job is to basically make it more accessible. I suppose the thing with dance, in a way, is the amazing thing is that it is already accessible. You know, there's this idea that you don't have to necessarily understand every single line, or you don't have to always kind of know exactly what's being said. You can just see an image, take it in, and decide what that is for yourself. And that's what I love about movement, but like creating it narratively and giving people the license then to see what they see. So we really just wanted to make all the works that were going to be in the festival accessible. And that's the best way to do that, to make sure that everyone understands everything through all of the pieces. And we want to keep that going
The story is still being told verbally, albeit that through Irish Sign Language in this particular case. I mentioned that you had worked with Matthew Bourne, and one of the things that Romeo and Juliet production was also filmed for Sky Arts. Did that feed in? Because you've had a couple of television choreographic experiences. I suppose I'm thinking specifically of the sci-fi series Moonhaven. What's the nature of choreography or of movement direction for a series like that, Roisin?
Yeah, it's a really different job in a great way. You know, it's really interesting. It's someone else's vision, right? So it's what the writer has written, and there's an element of you trying to bring that to life for them. Mm. And then there's this massive part of the camera angles, and what actually will people see, and will they only see 2 seconds of what will be a minute and a half of a movement or an image. So for me, there's a massive time of preparation for TV. So I also did choreography for season 2 of The Tourist as well, so that's just been nominated for loads of awards, which is amazing. But the main thing with that is trying to get actors to move. And in Moonhaven, they really had to dance. They had to...
Real
they
dancing.
Had set they had set a precedence that everyone on the moon had learned to dance as a child. So now all of your actors have to be amazing dancers because they've done it since they were young. So a lot of my job there was also like bringing them through loads of movement sessions and getting them really comfortable in their own body, so that when they do have to go out and do a full scene that's only movement, they're, you know, that's second nature.
Yeah, that they're not freaked out.
Exactly,
by that.
Exactly.
And I suppose some of the actors will not have had in themselves will not have had dancing lessons from very young, so you could be dealing with somebody who just needs to be persuaded that they can dance as much as anything else.
Yeah, you know, everyone puts on a song and dances in their room, so everyone can dance. I'm totally in agreement that everyone can move and everyone has rhythm and all of those things. It's just, you know, if someone was to put a camera in front of you, I think the same would happen. You know, that thing of, oh, the, if you haven't trained in, and obviously they're incredibly trained as actors in the way that they, you know, can deliver lines and everything. And I just premiered Circle Mirror Transformation at the Gate actually last night, and I also did the movement on that show.
And that opened last night, so I'm hoping
it opened last night.
I'm hoping to get to it in the next few nights myself, because I'm not going to be working for the next couple of nights at any rate. So that's neither here nor there. Róisín, thanks for being with us this evening. That's Róisín Whelan talking to us about Eva and Galaxy of Occupations, and you can go to the Carlow Arts Festival website for full details on that. But that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Who had we got with us? Niall Fitzmaurice and Barbara Sanwo were the Barbara Rose Sanwo were the researchers. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Aisling Grufferty was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme produced by Reg Luby. As I said, I won't be with you for the next couple of nights. I won't be here tomorrow. We're playing the highlights of both Yankari and Villagers on Monday on the bank holiday, and then Kay will be with you on Tuesday and Wednesday, and I will be back with you next Thursday. So enjoy the bank holiday weekend, and I will talk to you, as I say, in a week's time. John Creedon will be with you after the news.